The third case of the morning is number 02-2475, Robledo Gonzalez against the Attorney General.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Mary Sushati. I represent the petitioner in this case. This is a case that involves a review of a district court's decision in a petition for writ of habeas corpus filed by an alien who sought to have his right or to reassert his right to have his application for Section 212C relief reconsidered by the Board of Immigration Appeals. What makes this case depart from the usual case is that this alien was deported pursuant to a deportation order in which the board found that he had been stripped of eligibility for Section 212C under the Attorney General's interpretation of ADEPA that held that ADEPA can be applied retroactively to pending cases. That was matter of Soriano. Since 1997, when the board initially entered its original order and petitioner was deported to Mexico, Soriano was retracted. St. Cyr versus INS came down from the Supreme Court in 2001. Caltano Martinez, allowing aliens to have a right to habeas corpus relief if they were otherwise barred because of criminal convictions that underlay the deportation order, they had a right to habeas relief. And this petitioner, who by then had reentered the United States after having had that order executed, and finds himself under indictment for illegal reentry. And he sought to have a reassertion of his right to Section 212C relief, which he stated to the district court was unconstitutional. He was deprived of equal protection of the law. In the course of the habeas proceedings, he filed a motion to reopen with the board, attempting to ask the board to reopen the old deportation proceedings, even though they had been executed, to allow him, as it allowed for so many others who were still in the United States under non-executed deportation orders, to have his case reopened for that relief. The board denied the motion to reopen, citing Section 3.2 of the administrative rules for what essentially was lack of prosecution. Section 3.2 says that if a motion to reopen is filed with the board and afterwards the alien departs or is deported, that motion, the board loses jurisdiction. That wasn't the situation here. Petitioner left by order of deportation, which he challenges as wrongful, re-entered and then filed his motion to reopen and still stayed in the United States.
Couldn't he have filed his motion to reopen right after that denial?
Which denial?
Couldn't he have appealed right after the board's denial of his motion?
At that time, the writ of habeas corpus was pending. And the motion to reopen was filed during the pendency of the habeas petition. The question is whether or not this court was the appropriate place for appellate review of the motion to reopen.
Right.
And we go back to the judicial preclusion provisions in IRS Transitional Rules, Section 309C4, which said that aliens who are deportable by reason of criminal convictions cannot seek review of their deportation orders in the appellate court. This court has issued many cases that reaffirm that principle, matter of Chow, matter of Yang. If you don't have jurisdiction to consider the initial deportation order, there is no jurisdiction to consider the denial of the motion to reopen, because the alien has not been transformed from one who was deportable by reason of a criminal conviction to something else. He is still always that alien that is barred by the transitional rules. Therefore, in my opinion, there was no jurisdiction in the Seventh Circuit. One could argue that there was contemporaneous jurisdiction. In other words, that there might have been jurisdiction in the Seventh Circuit, or maybe it was jurisdiction in the district court on the habeas. But that invites duplicative types of actions, and sometimes those are disfavored. I firmly believe at the time that the writ of habeas corpus was filed that there was strong precedent from the Supreme Court's decision in Caltano Martinez, and by virtue of the transitional rules, which is the reason why he never appealed the original order of deportation. And since the motion to reopen had been adjudicated while the court had jurisdiction, the district court, it was appropriate for the court to review that motion to reopen, just as it had reviewed the underlying 1997 deportation order. So there is an inconsistency in the way the district court approached these issues. The question here is whether or not there was a denial of constitutional, that the petitioner had stated a sufficient constitutional challenge. One must keep in mind that in this circuit, and this case arises in this circuit, there was sufficient case law that precluded, number one, a review of a deportation order on account of an alien who had been convicted of a crime denominated as an aggravated felony or a crime involving moral turpitude. That was Yang, that was Chow, that was Arevalo Lopez. There was also the rule in Laguerre that upheld Soriano, essentially, by default. Laguerre said that there is no judicial review in this court or in the district court, and impliedly said Soriano was a good case. So of all the circuits, this was the only circuit that barred judicial review and that implicitly upheld Soriano. There was no opportunity in the context of this case to have gotten any fair hearing. This is the case of an alien who had filed for relief under Section 212C relief. It was denied on its merits by the immigration judge. He filed an appeal. He expected a review on the merits of that decision, but instead the board said, sorry, you just lost eligibility. And it didn't even refund his appellate fee. This is unfair. But how unfair is it? How deeply unfair does it become? Is it so unfair that it implicates the due process and the Equal Protection Clause? I submit that it does, and for these reasons. Number one, the Supreme Court indicated that you can't retroactively dash expectations. What is the expectation that was dashed here? The expectation that he was going to apply for relief and get a fair hearing. And then if he disagreed with the immigration judge's decision, he would be able to go to the board and argue why he disagreed with it, not to have the case and his eligibility truncated in the midst of an appeal, and then, under precedent decision, not be able to take judicial review of that decision. Most of the other circuits who have considered Soriano have repudiated it. Most of the other circuits who have considered whether there was habeas relief still remained after IRA and ADEPA have said, yes, it does. So for all of those other aliens in those other circuits, they wouldn't have been or achieved the situation that this petitioner achieved because they would have had the right to appeal, and if they didn't take the right to appeal to a district court, they waived it. If they didn't take their appeal to the board, they waived it. If they refused to file for 212Z relief, they waived it, except in this district, in this circuit. This petitioner is aggrieved, and doubly so. The other issue here involves whether or not there is an equal protection issue where the Attorney General has achieved a discriminatory attitude with respect to two classes of aliens that are essentially the same. And I speak and I direct my attention to a regulation that the Attorney General promulgated in 2001 that allowed aliens who were here, who had been lawful permanent residents, who had committed crimes that resulted in the divestiture of that lawful permanent residency status, who were denied the right to apply for 212C relief, or at least to pursue it under Soriano, and who were ordered deported, but they never crossed the borders into a foreign country. They were never put on an airplane bound for Europe or anywhere else. Those people can now reapply and file a motion to reopen. Whereas the same type of person, the LPR, denied 212C relief or the opportunity to pursue it, who has got an order of deportation because he forfeited his right to permanent residence by committing crimes, is put on an airplane or tossed across the border and has no right to apply to reopen. We contend that that is a denial of equal protection. Now, I understand that the equal protection balancing test really doesn't require much in the way of a showing from the government to say that this motive is discriminatory. But there are certain things that kind of jump out and grab you by the throat, and this is one case, at least for my purposes, jumped out and grabbed me by the throat because I said this is really unfair. This isn't just this petitioner who's harmed. It is his wife and his children who are U.S. citizens who are harmed. Although they're not in front of this court, they're just as much deprived of equal protection because they don't have a father and they don't have a husband. And yes, of course, I know that this man's commission of these drug crimes presumptively divested him of any right to remain in this country. But 212C said, we will give it to you if you can prove you will be law-abiding, if you can prove that you've got strong family ties in this country, which he has. And I'm not going to go back and figure out why the immigration judge denied that relief, because I don't think that's part of our case. What we're saying here is that he needed to reassert that. He had a right to reassert that. He was denied simply because he was deported. You see, the execution of a deportation order is meaningless if there's something wrong with that deportation order. The INS, the Attorney General, has said all of the deportation orders that we have entered based on Soriano, erroneous as it was, are non-final for you who stayed here. They're final for you who left. What does that do? It encourages an absconder. It encourages somebody to go into a cellar and stay there and not be detected by the INS. Meanwhile, somebody who does adhere to a deportation order and is deported, comes back illegally or returns, challenges that deportation order as being inherently invalid, that person has a final order. That doesn't work that way, at least not in my understanding. And it shouldn't work that way. If the Attorney General was wrong in this case, he was wrong in everybody else's case. He was wrong because he applied an incorrect rule of retroactivity, the Supreme Court has held, and now by the fiction of actually saying, well, we've deported you, now you don't have any right to come back and challenge that order, ignores the fact that this is a continuing aggrievement. By the virtue of the deportation order, he's permanently barred from returning. It isn't even a question whether the Attorney General is going to grant permission to have him reenter or not. He's permanently barred. And so he's permanently barred from seeing his children in the United States. He's permanently barred from being with his wife in the United States. He's permanently barred from being a husband and a father. That is a continuing controversy, in my opinion. That is a continuing aggrievement, in my opinion. And the idea of finality doesn't work in such a situation.
Counselor, you are into your rebuttal time, if you would like to.
Am I finished?
I have five minutes of your time left. And I noticed that you had reserved.
Having had the wind at my back or the cold at my back, I think I'll just move forward and spare the court seeing me again. The question of due process, again, is the balancing act. If you are going to have a procedure, an administrative procedure, that starts out with an immigration judge entertaining an application for relief, taking evidence and testimony, and putting the alien to the trouble of documenting his eligibility and testifying and so forth, and paying attorneys by all means for this process. And then the judge says, well, yeah, you're eligible, but for whatever reason, I'm not going to give it to you. For whatever reason. And there's a long list of requirements under matter of merit. He might not have fulfilled one, or the judge had a bad day. Who knows how these things work sometimes. Now he takes an appeal, and of course he does hire a lawyer again and pays the appellate fee, and all of a sudden, the next thing we know, he doesn't have eligibility anymore. That's not due process. Because the expectation is that I'm going to get an appeal. The expectation is I'm going to argue my case. So you argue point A, B, and C, and the board comes back and says, I'm sorry, but point A, B, and C are not relevant anymore. We're going to find point F. Without giving him a chance to say, well, we might deny this on point F. Would you like to file a brief and discuss point F? They didn't even do that. In fact, the Attorney General never warned anybody that it was coming down with matter of Soriano, and I illustrate that in a footnote in my brief of a very excellent law review article on how the Justice Department, God bless its soul, does a lot of policy making through litigation, and Soriano was one of the creatures of that attempt. In any case, I would ask the court to give this a fair look. This petitioner deserves that. His children deserve it, his wife deserves it, and actually, the whole administrative process deserves it.
Let me ask you one question. At what point do immigration decisions and deportations become final? For example, if Congress changes the law again tomorrow and says that convictions for aggravated felonies are not a bar to discretionary relief from deportation, should an alien who was convicted and deported since the 1996 amendment now be able to illegally reenter the country and challenge the prior deportation?
We're talking about a piece of legislation, a statute, as opposed to an interpretation of the statute, which is what happened here when the Attorney General interpreted retroactivity in Soriano. We're talking about if Congress says at one point, and there's always an effective date, we all know that legislation is either going to be completely prospective or Congress specifically says it's going to be prospective and retroactive and everybody's barred. So one of the things that is inheres in legislation is that there is a sense, a person is given a sense of where that legislation is to start or where it's to end. Whereas this wasn't the case here. This was essentially rulemaking by decision that unexpectedly told everybody, I'm sorry, we're going to apply ADEPA, 440D ADEPA retroactively to you, even though your case did not arise under those circumstances. And that's the seminal difference.
Thank you.
I'm going to have to pick up my papers here. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll hear now from Mr. Sandu.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Hafu Sandu on behalf of the respondents, appellees. Your Honor, we would ask that this Court affirm the District Court's dismissal and dismiss this appeal for lack of jurisdiction. And I'd like to start by just making some preliminary points that I think are significant to this case. First of all, it is true that the petitioner in 1995 received a full hearing before an immigration judge on his claim for Section 212C relief. The immigration judge balanced the equities in the case, the adverse factors, including the petitioner's drug conviction, found him deportable from the country, which is not disputed in this case. The only issue was whether or not he merited, as a matter of pure discretion, a grant of Section 212C relief. The immigration judge found that he did not, in the exercise of discretion. So the claim was heard on the merits. There was a final deportation order after the board affirmed, and there was no attempt by the petitioner in that case to seek judicial review either in the district court or the court of appeals. No court, including the Supreme Court, has held that jurisdiction does not exist in either court. It is true that this court, the Seventh Circuit, had held that there was no district court jurisdiction and that claims could have been heard in the court of appeals but for constitutional questions and serious, I think the term was, bizarre miscarriages of justice. So I think it's stretching the point to say that the petitioner had no recourse to judicial review at that point. Nevertheless, he did not seek review in any court. He was deported at that time. He didn't re-enter the country after St. Cyr or after the regulation. He entered within a year.
So your view is he could have brought the mousetrapping issue to us at that point?
Yes, Your Honor. We set forth that argument in our briefs. He could have at least tried. In fact, a number of aliens, in the midst of the confusion surrounding the 1996 reforms, attempted to go both to this court and to the district court. In those cases where they went to the district court and this court subsequently found that review was proper here, this court, in fact, exercised its discretion to allow those aliens, I can cite you Musto, the Perryman, Chow, Laguerre, all that whole line of cases where the courts allow the aliens to have jurisdiction in the district court because of the confusion in the case law. I think the significant point here is that there was no attempt at all to go to any court.
So your view is we would have either heard his case or we would have indicated that he could take his complaint to the district court.
That's correct, Your Honor. In fact, at that point, I think it was early 1997 when the board decided the case, there was no really clear case law on either the jurisdictional issue or contrary to opposing counsel's assertions on the Section 440D issue, the Soriano issue. In fact, as I recall, the first case issued by this court was a case called Reyes-Hernandez in late 1996, in which the court refused to apply Section 440D. So it was not clear at all, but in light of that fact, there was no attempt to seek judicial review. Also, I would point out to the court that this set of facts presents the quintessential example of a civil case that's closed. I'm not sure that you can have an example that's more clear where there's a case that's closed. Here, not only was a deportation order entered, but it was executed. The alien was removed. There was a bar.
This was self-deportation, wasn't it?
I'm not sure. I think it was the alien may have departed under an order of deportation, which executes the deportation order, but it may have been self-deportation. I don't recall from the facts.
Anyway, he left.
In either event, the deportation was executed, and he was inadmissible. He could not return to the country for a period of 5 years, but he decided to take matters into his own hand and illegally re-enter the country. Now,
is there a viable defense to the criminal charge on the basis of the legality of the earlier deportation order?
Well, in fact, Your Honor, as our briefs indicate, the petitioner did attempt to already collaterally attack his deportation order in the criminal proceedings by moving to dismiss the indictment. And our briefs indicate that we cite two cases actually on Westlaw, which indicates that motion was denied by the district court judge in the case.
And that is now pending here, am I correct?
And that case is pending on appeal, that's right, Your Honor. And in that case, the district court determined that the collateral attack to the deportation order failed because he could not demonstrate prejudice in light of the fact that he received a full hearing already on his claim for 212C relief. Now, Your Honors, I'd like to get to some of the jurisdictional problems in this case now. And the first one, I think, which this court has to look at before it can go forth, is the question of whether this particular alien is in custody of the INS. There is no deportation order now that can be executed. There is no proceedings that have been commenced by the INS against the petitioner. The petitioner is serving a lengthy prison sentence. He's in the custody of the criminal authorities. And there's no evidence that there's been any sort of detainer or anything like that, which...
Who would be the proper party respondent if he was in the custody of the INS?
Your Honor, it would be the INS district director.
And who would be the appropriate authority if at the time of the filing of the petition for writ of habeas corpus, he was in custody because of the criminal charge?
Well, he's not... To challenge the criminal charges?
He is technically in the custody of whoever is holding him for the criminal charges. Who is the proper party respondent?
I would assume it would be the warden, Your Honor, who exercises day-to-day control over the correctional facility.
Neither one of those people, neither the district director nor the warden of the facility where he's held, is the proper party respondent. Is may name as a party respondent in this case, am I right?
I think they've named the Attorney General and the INS, Your Honor, I believe.
Okay. Now, is the government satisfied with that, or do we have a failure to name the proper party respondent here?
Your Honor, I don't recall exactly all of the parties that they listed, but we would argue, I think, in the first instance, that there's a problem of custody under 2241.
Well, that's a chicken and egg problem, really. I mean, I'm presenting you with the possibility, but we talked about silver bullets in the earlier case, and a silver bullet here, too. Can you correct on appeal the naming of the wrong party respondent?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think that's waived, if that's a defect in the complaint. So, Your Honor, if that were the case, we would ask the court to dismiss on that basis as well.
Well, is there any relief you could get here that would affect the custody?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because that issue is in the criminal proceedings, so that there may be another defect in terms of the remedy that's available to him, in terms of his criminal proceedings.
Well, isn't that the point you made in your brief, that in fact, if he was in anybody's custody at the time of the filing of the petition, it was the person holding him for the criminal charge?
Yes, Your Honor.
You folks had not filed any papers to hold him for the with respect to a immigration violation.
Right, and there is a provision in the Immigration Act which allows the Attorney General to reinstate an order that's been executed. So that could be a possibility, but there's no indication that the INS has any desire to do so. Usually, in these types of cases, the INS will wait until the prison term is over, and it's, I think he was sentenced to 57 months or so. So there's no possibility of that, I would think, in the foreseeable future. So we would ask that the court to dismiss the case, the appeal, on that basis alone. We've also, Your Honor, presented some arguments on subject matter jurisdiction in our briefs, and I'd like to just quickly go over those, particularly with the issue of the motion to reopen. I think
we'd all appreciate you doing it, but not too quickly. This is a hornet's nest for us.
Yes, Your Honor.
We don't want the chances of some archaeologists digging this case up in a time capsule 1,000 years from now is disturbing. I mean, whether we have jurisdiction or the district court has jurisdiction is getting to the point of the kind of problem where, you know, how many angels dance on the head of a pin. So if you can illuminate this for us, I think we'd all be appreciative.
Yes, Your Honor. Let me first make a distinction between the review of the denial of the motion to reopen versus review over what appears to be the collateral attack on the 1997 deportation order. The government's position would be as to the 1997 deportation order, that that's not reviewable because that's been executed and the alien's been deported and then illegally reentered.
In your view, that's not, no court looks at that.
No court looks at that. In fact, we cite to Seventh Circuit case law that talks about the presumption against review over executed deportation orders unless the alien can show a gross miscarriage of justice. In that, so that there is that possibility. However, let me also say, Your Honor, as we set forth in our briefs, that the deportation order being executed is independently precluded also by a prior provision in the law which applies in this case because it's a transitional rule, and that was the 106C provision, which says that that once the order has been executed, it can't be looked at by a court.
And now, putting that aside for a minute,
yes.
we have a district court, we have a court of appeals. Who can look at what now?
So we believe that the court of appeals could have considered the denial of the motion to reopen, that was the board's denial of the motion to reopen, through a petition for review filed directly in this court. And we would point the court to this circuit's case law that we've cited in our brief, particularly the Lara Ruiz decision and the Flores decision. I believe the Flores decision actually was post St. Cyr, and the court in that case considered the constitutional questions that were involved in that case, particularly the issues of procedural due process before the immigration judge.
Now, has a petition for review of the denial of the motion to reopen in fact been filed here, and was it in a timely manner?
It was not filed, Your Honor, and that's the basis of the district court's decision dismissing that part of the case.
Okay. And so, in your view, there is nothing for us to look at now, is that right?
There is nothing for this court to look at.
From the denial of the petition for review?
From the denial of the motion to reopen, yes, Your Honor. And so we would ask on that additional basis that the court would affirm the district court's dismissal. That is the basis of the district court's decision in this case. But so, just to make that clear, we're saying that there's no review over either the 1997 deportation order, it's a collateral attack, or over the denial of the motion to reopen, which presumptively would be reviewable in the Court of Appeals on a petition for review. And the circuit has found, after St. Cyr and Calcano, that constitutional claims may be reviewed still in the Court of Appeals.
Assuming that there was a petition for review filed in a timely manner, could we, on that review, look at the question of the constitutionality of the non-retroactivity of the Supreme Court cases, position taken by the Attorney General? Could we then look at that?
I don't believe so. The court could look at what the board decided, the basis of the board's decision, and there was, which was one, that the board had no jurisdiction in the case because the petition was deported.
That's right.
And I think the court could also look at the equal protection claim because that was a challenge brought. There was a motion reopened claiming that the petitioner should be allowed, even though he'd been deported, should be allowed to apply for 212C relief, and that the regulation violated equal protection. I think the court could look at those two things because that's a constitutional claim, and that
the second one really arises out of the position the Attorney General has taken.
Yeah, it relates to that issue. So that would have been the recourse. The petitioner would have had recourse.
Okay. Now, what was appropriate for the district court to look at as opposed to the Court of Appeals? What was properly before the district court?
Your Honor, we don't think that the district court has jurisdiction over any of the claims. The other claim would be the challenge to the 1997 deportation order itself, which is based on the subsequent decision in St. Cyr.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, we would say that, first of all, again, there's a custody problem, or as Your Honor referred to it, naming the proper party.
Problem, yeah.
And then we don't think, Your Honor, that there's jurisdiction there because, again, 106C, if you look at the language 106C, that order was executed. And so that the deportation order, when it was executed in 1997, under old 106C, and let me give you the USC site, 8 USC 1105AC, under that provision, there's no jurisdiction to review and execute a deportation order. And that provision also says that if the order has been challenged in another criminal or civil proceeding, that there's no review over it here. Mm-hmm. The order has been challenged in a criminal proceeding.
Mm-hmm.
So, that would be one reason why there would be no jurisdiction in the district court of the 1997 deportation. Another reason would be, again, under this circuit's case law, going back to the question of whether the gross miscarriage of justice. As we've set forth in our briefs, we don't believe that there's been a gross miscarriage of justice here. Under the Supreme Court civil case law regarding retroactivity for civil cases, a new judicial decision that's issued does not apply to a case that's already closed.
If there were a gross miscarriage of justice, that would be cognizable in the district court. Is that your view?
That's right, Your Honor.
I see.
That's right, Your Honor.
Your time has expired. Unless my colleagues have further questions, you have our thanks, Mr. Sanders.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And I believe, Ms. that your time had expired. So we thank you as well for your presentation today, and the case will be taken under advisement.